For almost 15 years, Matthew Diffie's uniquely funny single-panel cartoons have appeared in The New Yorker magazine, winning him countless fans, awards, and yes, even more fodder for cartoons. His new book, Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart Attractive People, is a mix of cartoons, visual riffs, and illustrated one-liners that will appeal to anyone, even smart, attractive people. The collection contains Diffie's funniest drawings and writings from the past decade, as well as all new cartoons and sketches organized into categories based on profession and circumstance. It is a great pleasure to welcome back the very amusing Matthew Diffie to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. It was good to have you here.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to have you aboard. How did this particular collection come about?
Well, I needed to do another book, and I wanted to do a book of my own stuff. And the publisher said you should build a theme around your stuff. And most books, you know, define the audience by the theme. So they'll do like a cat book of cat cartoons or something. And so I just wanted to do something for the people that I know like my work, which are all the smart, attractive people in the world. And so there you go. The limited audience, but, you know, they like it a lot. They appreciate it.
The hand-drawn implies that you are doing it special for them, for these smart,
oh, right,
attractive people.
Exactly. None of that robo-drawing that you hear about.
No, very a craftsman.
Artisanal drawings.
Absolutely. How much of this is new? How much of this is stuff that has appeared in the New Yorker? How did that work?
Yeah, most of the single-panel cartoons in the book have appeared in the New Yorker. That was the starting point. And then from there, once I figured out, you know, because the book is divided into different little chapters for different types of smart, attractive people. So there's a chapter for, like, smart, attractive medical professionals, smart, attractive lumberjacks. I don't know. They're pretty much any category you can think of. And so as I started forming the categories, then I realized, oh, there's more jokes that I can make. So I started doing custom new cartoons and material for each chapter. And then each chapter also has its own little sort of, I don't know, introductory riff and some multi-panel stuff, which I don't get to do much in The New Yorker. So,
do you like that? Do you like that opportunity? It would seem like give you some
it's
freedom.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, the single panel, there's something really pure about a single panel cartoon. It's one picture, one joke, you know, bam. But it's nice to be able to deliver, you know, a series of jokes and kind of build a little bit of a rhythm and just to progress a thought further than the one single instance.
So, for example, you have a multi-panel in here on Interview with a Chip Critic.
Yeah. He's a food critic, but he specializes, right, in chips.
Yes.
So, yes, it's a very serious conversation with him.
And an understanding of what he does, and quite frankly, the importance of his work.
Oh, it's super important to him, at least. Yeah. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I you know, I used to do, and I still do a lot for other people, but people that know me at The New Yorker just know me for one single style of work, which is The New Yorker style. So, yeah, it's nice to throw that stuff in there.
Talk a little bit about that. How much of what we see in The New Yorker, when we see your stuff in The New Yorker, is that their style that you are sort of crafting yourself toward, or is that very much you that happens to fit into the openness of the magazine?
Yeah, that's a good question and an important point to make. It is, in the best of places, it's a combination of both, and in my case, I think it is. You know, I found The New Yorker, and it is a perfect place for me to do the single, like, one-liner joke with a drawing that I do love doing. But what you see of mine in The New Yorker is, of course, a combination of what I like and what The New Yorker likes. So I do 10 a week, you know, sort of ideas that I sketch up. And they'll buy one, you know, that's just the way it works. And so what you see is a combination. It's what they agreed with me. So there's obviously lots of stuff in my batch of cartoons every week that may be more specific to me. But still, the single panel format does suit me very well. So it's lucky that The New Yorker exists, and I found them, and they found me, so it is a perfect match.
Of course, the rejection collection was part of this, but with those nine that don't get picked up, then what can you do anything you want with them then?
Yeah, you can take them wherever you would like. There's just not very many other markets these days,
right?
Sadly. But A lot of people put them online, which is something I probably should do more of. But, you know, sometimes those ideas, you know, if they're, you know, if they're rejected because they're just not quite there, sometimes you put them away and look at them again, you know, a few weeks later or a few months later, and you can figure out, oh, it just needs this little tweak. So I guess that's why I'm hesitant to publish them elsewhere, even on the internet, because I still hope that I'll fix the puzzle at some point.
Are any of those that have, quote-unquote, been rejected in this particular collection?
Oh, sure. Yeah, lots of them.
Yeah.
I don't have the book in front of me, but probably the more racy, rowdier ones in the book didn't make it into the New Yorker for good reason.
Which I assume you know going in,
but
then that helps narrow it down?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, cartoonists are... you know, we're a certain type of person. And if we come up with a joke, whether it's appropriate for the New Yorker, if it makes us laugh and we think it'll make other cartoonists laugh, we're going to do it, whether it's right for the New Yorker or not.
Right.
And, you know, that's just the way we're built. So we do those cartoons anyway, even when, though we know they're not going to run them in the fancy literary magazine like the New Yorker.
Having spoken to many, many New Yorker cartoonists over the years, I this is the common answer, and I believe I've even discussed this with you in the past, which is that with that said, you never really know which one will be selected, if any will be selected, on any given week.
Yeah, it's always a little bit of a surprise. I mean, sometimes you know. Sometimes if everything in your batch is pretty lame and you have one that's really stellar and it fits the New Yorker sort of zone, you can have a pretty good bet that that's going to be the one. But, you know, sometimes if you're really doing good work, you're going to have three or four that are, you know, buyable. And sometimes they buy the one that's more New Yorker-y funny, which is this very specific tone. And sometimes they surprise you, actually, and buy the one that is a little rowdier, which they've definitely done in the past with me. So, yeah, it's a bit of a surprise, but I don't know. I guess you probably know about 30%. 30% accuracy, which is not very accurate.
And you could, are you always asked to bring in at least 10, in the sense you can't be cocky and say, all right, here are my three?
No. I mean, you could, but I think, yeah, that you're less likely to sell. I think everyone else is doing it, 10 a week, and, you know, Bob Mankoff, who's the cartoon editor,
right.
He has plenty of cartoons to fill the magazine. So he's going to reward, I think, the person who's putting in the time and giving him, you know, lots of options.
We were just talking to Roz Chass about this not too long ago, but if you look in an average year, you can sell maybe 25, 30 cartoons, which really doesn't seem like a lot, especially considering for those of us, if we're looking for your particular cartoon, it seems like you're in more than that.
Yeah. There's a lot of us that are all, you know, vying for spots, and yeah, 25 or 30 is great at the New Yorker, and it's not, you know, it's a rarefied sort of gym-like thing to have a New Yorker cartoon, and it's not bulk consumption for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you're thrilled every time you get one in.
Do you like the cartoon, do you like the caption contest?
Yeah, sure. I know some of the other cartoonists are really down on it.
Yes.
But I think it's fun. I think people, you know, like to engage with what we're doing, and if that helps them understand what at least half of the work we do is, that's great.
And as you say, some of the cartoonists are down on it. It seems generational to me that there are some of the older cartoonists that feel that you're giving away the joke and that it's taking away from the craft of what you do.
I suppose so, in some small way. But at the same time, we've got to adapt our craft to modern sensibilities. So, you know, if people love doing it, then it's great. I don't consider myself like a real fancy pants artist, and some of the cartoons do, and so they think that what we do is some magic, you know, thing. And I don't think that. I mean, you just have to look at Twitter and realize that there's a lot of really clever people that are making fun jokes, especially
right.
off of one consistent setup. If you start, you know, like a meme, a lot of people can do little riffs off that once the foundation is created, which is what a caption contest is. The artist has already, you know, drawn a situation that is ripe for a joke. And to think that only professional cartoonists should be allowed to do that or able to do that seems silly to me.
What do you think makes you a professional cartoonist? I mean, besides selling, what do you think the ingredients are to be a successful professional cartoonist?
Oh, man. Well, you obviously have to have a high tolerance for rejection, at least at the New Yorker, because that is just part of it. And I think that's part of comedy in general. Everybody that I know that's a comedian or a comedy writer, it's just you just crank out a lot of ideas to get the good ones. You have to somewhat enjoy working alone, I think. You have to just be a little off in the way you think about mm-hmm. the world and the way you go about it. And I don't know, it helps to have some knowledge of comedy writing and being able to draw somewhat, although that's not the most important thing. Ooh. I don't know, there's probably other deeper psychological things that I'm not aware of.
Neurotic? Being neurotic?
Maybe. Maybe.
Yeah. And as far as the art, though, I mean, that's one thing about your work is that, it is, there's many of these that are just beautiful. I mean, they're very well done.
Thank you. Yeah, I went to school for art, so I feel like I have to, take advantage of that money I spent. No, I like drawings that are a little more realistic than cartoony. It just suits my comedic style, I think, just a little bit of a drier delivery rather than a wacky, zany thing. I don't know. That's just the way I draw. Can't really analyze it too much, but I appreciate the compliment.
Of course, you're known for the rejection collections. Will you be doing more of those?
Not sure. No plans right now, but, there's always new cartoonists coming in that have new piles of rejects that are stacking up. So we have, we're setting them aside always in hopes that there would be. So if there's a publisher out there listening and they want to take a stab at it, give me a call.
In the meantime, the new book is Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. It is published by Scribner. Matthew Diffie, a great pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. Matthew Diffie is the author. It is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.